visit Perimeter. So today's talk is, in a certain sense, it's a part two of the talk that I gave on Friday in the mathematical physics seminar, which is fundamentally about the same objects. But today's talk will be very much a complementary perspective on that talk. And I certainly won't assume that anyone in the audience here today was at the Friday talk. But I mentioned this just for the audience back home, if anyone has seen the videos. Okay, so the talk today is about, among other things, Legendrian knots. And Legendrian knots are special types of knots that satisfy a geometric condition. And because they satisfy a geometric condition, it is impossible for a human to correctly draw a Legendrian knot. But computers can draw Legendrian knots. And so I was very happy to see, back in September, this picture appear on the cover of the Notices of the AMS. So what this picture is a picture of is actually, it's not a picture of a full Legendrian knot, but it's a picture of arc segments that run along a Legendrian knot. And so there are a couple of things going on in this picture. So first of all, in this picture, space, just Euclidean R3, is filled with a collection of two planes. And the two planes twist as you move from point to point in space in a certain way. And then the geometric condition on this Legendrian knot is that the tangent vector to the knot always has to lie in the two plane. So the knot always has to move around inside the two planes. And because the two planes twist, the Legendrian knots have to twist in space. And the twisting depends on where the knot is. So if you're near the vertical axis, these planes are effectively close to being horizontal. And so you see this Legendrian knot in the center has to spiral very rapidly. And as you move further away from the axis, these planes become more vertical and twist more slowly, and you see the knots spiral less further away from the axis. Okay, so actually, another thing that's really nice about this figure, which you probably can't read, but down at the bottom it gives a title for this. It's called the Heisenberg sculpture. And so that's a really apt title. So this picture, although it's not clear, has a very large group of non-abelian symmetries. And those non-abelian symmetries also play a very big role in the story that I'm going to tell today. And so my larger goal in this talk today is just to explain the relation between these special knots, this hidden non-abelian symmetry, and this picture, and the structure of n equals 2 supersymmetry in three dimensions. Okay, so that's basically all I had. That is my one slide. For the talk, and the rest of the talk is going to be a Blackboard talk. Okay, so this talk is about fundamentally d equals 3, n equals 2 supersymmetry containing a U1 R symmetry. Now, a very natural observable in any quantum field theory with this symmetries would be the chiral ring. So the chiral ring is just a subset of operators, which if we consider the four supercharges, which I'll just call Q alpha and Q twiddle alpha, where alpha runs from 1 to 2, the chiral ring is generated by operators which are annihilated by either Q or Q twiddle. And this is a very important observable in these quantum field theories. So the talk today is not about the chiral ring, but about a kind of refinement of the chiral ring, which you might call the 1/4 BPS subsector. So what I mean by a 1/4 BPS is the following. What I'll do is I'll just pick one of these four supercharges in the theory, just call it Q. And so of course, the choice of Q corresponds to the choice of a non-vanishing spinner C. So C is just a fixed spinner. I make the choice of Q, and then I just look at operators which are annihilated by Q. Such operators could be local or non-local. And in fact, in the example today with the knots, they'll all be non-local operators, but one can consider any operator one likes. And now, the reason why people don't usually talk about the 1/4 BPS subsector of n equals 2 theories, it's just that it doesn't really have a natural definition. To make this notion of the 1/4 BPS sensible, I had to pick the spinner. And the spinner breaks the rotation symmetries of Euclidean R3. So this is not a rotation or if you like, Lorentz invariant notion in the quantum field theory. So what we've done is we've taken R3 in Euclidean signature with its spin three, or SU2 symmetries. And we're effectively making it, when we make this choice of the spinner, we're effectively making a decomposition or a reduction in the symmetry to thinking about R3 as a product of just a distinguished direction R times the complex plane on which now we have a reduced symmetry group, just spin 2, or U1 that acts. And the special U1 that preserves the sector is just the U1 that acts on my spinner by a phase, so it acts on Q by a phase, and this equation is preserved. Okay, now, what can we say about operators in this 1/4 BPS subsector? Well, just very immediately, if we think about the supersymmetry algebra, which in some standard basis I can write as Q1, Q total 1 is equal to I d dt, where t is going to be the coordinate on R, and then I can say Q1, Q total 2 is equal to, again, in some standard conventions, d dz bar, where z bar will be, where z is the holomorphic coordinate on C. Then I immediately see that if I identify my Q, just by convention, with Q1, then I see that, well, that reading these commutators from right to left, both ddt and ddz bar are Q-trivial operators. And so that immediately means that if I consider correlation functions of any operator in this 1/4 BPS subsector, or of operators in this 1/4 BPS subsector, then these correlation functions are independent of t and vary holomorphically with respect to z. So these are holomorphic on the complex plane. So, of course, what this means is for this sector of operators behaves very much like the chiral algebra of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. Okay, so, but again, this notion only makes sense once we break this symmetry. So now my motivation for thinking about this class of operators in n equals 2 field theories actually comes from not so much thinking about supersymmetric quantum field theories, but thinking about the structure of three-dimensional bosonic Chern-Simons gauge theory. So this perspective, this motivation is actually very important for the things I'm going to say later. So let me motivate. Of course, one can just consider this abstractly if one likes, but let me give some more motivation for considering the structure. So Chern-Simons gauge theory. So the most important thing to know if you didn't know anything else about Chern-Simons theory is the following. So if I consider Chern-Simons theory on some compact closed three-manifold M, which you might just take to be the three-sphere, then if I take M and I cut it along any surface into two pieces, so here the surface I'll call sigma, so I decompose M into pieces along sigma. An example that's very familiar is just to take the three sphere and cut it up into two solid tori, and then sigma is just a torus. Then in this case, because of the gauge anomaly for Chern-Simons theory on a manifold with boundary, there must be a two-dimensional chiral algebra, just the WZW chiral current algebra, that lives on sigma. So sigma, when we cut, has this chiral current algebra, curly A of sigma. So that's the standard most important thing to know about Chern-Simons theory. Now, when I say sigma is a chiral current algebra, of course, to make sense of what that means is I have to give sigma not just the structure as an oriented topological surface, but actually as a Riemann surface. So it has to carry a complex structure. So I can make sense of what it means for correlation functions to depend holomorphically on sigma. So there's some complex structure giving me complex coordinates little z, and I'll just call the complex structure J. The dependence on the complex structure on sigma is actually very subtle in the theory. One way to understand it just from perturbation theory would be that if we want to do perturbation theory in Chern-Simons gauge theory on this manifold, then we'll have to fix a gauge at some point to do any computation. And to fix a gauge, that means we'll have to inevitably choose a metric on the three-manifold M. And that metric induces a boundary metric on sigma when we cut. And if you have a surface with a metric, that automatically means you've picked a complex structure on the surface. So even in perturbation theory, you've inevitably put a complex structure on sigma. So now there's something that's I've always found a little bit troubling about this, which is the relation between the bulk theory, the bulk Chern-Simons theory, and this chiral current algebra is very non-canonical. It's non-canonical because of, for instance, the need to put the complex structure on sigma. And keeping track of that is complicated business. One way to kind of emphasize this point is just that there are many different ways. If I give you a closed three-manifold, there are many different ways that I could cut it to see this chiral algebra. Of course, there's a topological choice in the genus of sigma, but then there's also a geometric choice. If I imagine putting a metric on my manifold M and then just deforming sigma by a little bit inside M, that will change the induced complex structure, and the chiral algebra in that sense changes. So this is a very non-canonical picture. When you're doing geometry, anytime you meet, it's always best to avoid non-canonical choices. The example is always picking a basis for a vector space. Sometimes you need to pick a basis, but that's always kind of an inelegant thing to do. And in geometry, it's much better, rather than making a single non-canonical choice, would be to make all non-canonical choices simultaneously. So here you can imagine, if we want to try to remove this non-canonical choice of this surface sigma required to see the chiral algebra, you can imagine that we try to make all cuttings of the three-manifold M along surfaces simultaneously. So we can consider all possible cuttings of the three-manifold M along surfaces. So we pick many, many different surfaces inside M along which we can cut, if you like, filling M in some way by surfaces. And on every surface when we cut, we get a chiral algebra attached to that surface. And you can imagine in some fantasy world trying to take this family of chiral algebras attached to surfaces, or maybe even just local pieces of surfaces inside the three-manifold, and putting them together into a kind of global, coherent chiral algebra on the entire three-manifold, something that you might call Hurley A of M, a 3D chiral algebra, with the property that the restriction, so this is just an algebra of local some operators, with the property that the restriction of this algebra to any of these surfaces along which you could, in principle, cut, produces this thing, A of sigma.
But you get A sigma is actually an algebra of local operators, if you put an actual boundary for this, right? I mean, if I take some sigma without cutting the boundary, just building a phase space, the algebra controls the phase space, but not, it's not local. If you mean anything about it, local operators, loose sense.
Actually, I'm going to answer all this question, I think. Ask me this question again at the end of the talk, and I'll see exactly. I'm going to give you an example of this, actually. In fact, I'm going to give you kind of a trivial example, actually, of what I mean right now, and then by the end of the talk, I'll give you another example. Yeah, so to say, we can ask lots of questions about exactly what this picture is going to mean, but let me give you a kind of example where it's clear at least what it should mean. The example is just in the context. So that's a kind of vague picture for an arbitrary three-manifold. Let me consider, though, a very kind of specific class of three-manifolds. So if I consider three-manifolds which fiber over the circle, so the fibrations, the topology of this manifold is just controlled by the choice of some monodromy for the fibration. Call it phi. And the mapping class group of this surface. Now, okay, so this kind of structure, this kind of fibered manifold, a good way to think about it is this is an example of a manifold with an example of a Codeman-Schwann one foliation. The leaves of the foliation are just sigma here. And it's actually kind of a special kind of foliation because this manifold emits a nice metric. So if I want to, I could put a metric on this three manifold of the fibers over the circle compatibly with the structure of the fibration just by, I picked some symplectic form. I picked some closed two form on M, which restricts to a symplectic form on sigma. I pick a fiberwise complex structure on all of the leaves, so just call that J. And then I can just pull back the angular form from the base. And I can make an isometric compatible with this fibration, for which the fibers here are some calibrated submanifolds of M. Okay, so this is some class of three manifolds that I put some class of metrics on them. And now in this case, it's kind of clear what this kind of global object A of M should be, because it's obvious that if I can imagine attaching, so every one of these fibers, if I want to at least make this picture metrically, I pick in a particular fiberwise complex structure, every one of these fibers has a natural current algebra sitting over it. And then now I just have a one parameter family of these current algebras parameterized by the circle. And moreover, in this picture, I have as the complex structure here varies on the fiber, I have the stress tensor in this current algebra. It gives me a connection that allows me to, that simply amounts to, allows me to say how the correlation functions in any one of these parallel algebras vary as I vary the complex structure and move from fiber to fiber. So in this case of the fiber three manifold, it's kind of clear what this thing A of M should be. It's just a one parameter family of chiral algebras with a connection. The thing about this picture is that it's not, in the world of three manifold, it's not a completely general picture, because if I have any manifold with this structure, the fibers over the circle, then necessarily the circle here gives me a generator in the first homology. So these manifolds all have positive Betti numbers. So this is not some general way of thinking about this object, but it's just an example of what this sort of thing should be. Okay, so what the talk is about how to understand an example of an object like A of M using, by looking at not the bosonic transformer theory, but the structure of operators in an equals, but the one-half BPS sector of operators in a supersymmetric version of Chern-Simons gauge theory. That one-half BPS subsector has the right properties, basically that it varies holomorphically in a particular direction, in a particular planar direction, to correspond to what you might think this algebra A of M should be. Okay, so so to understand this story with the n equals 2 supersymmetry, we have to put the n equals 2 field theory on the three manifold. And that's a standard story, but the thing to emphasize is there are always choices involved in how we put a quantum field theory on a curved manifold. And so I'm going to make a particular choice. In many ways, it's the most robust choice. And so the choice is the following. So when we put a quantum field theory on a curved manifold, we usually, if we're going to do it by topological twisting, we make some choice for a canonical supersymmetry algebra to work with. And usually that choice would be just the standard choice in the old days, just to make the flat Euclidean supersymmetry algebra. For what I'm going to do today, I'm going to make a different choice. I'm going to work with my tautological choice. Starting point will be a curved supersymmetry algebra on R3 and not the flat one. So this curved space supersymmetry algebra, which is really just it's a special case of the rigid supergravity formalism is one way to think about it. The starting point for this supersymmetry algebra, which you might call Heisenberg supersymmetry, is just to use the identification of R3 as the non-abelian Heisenberg Lie group. So when I think about R3 with its non-abelian group structure, Heisenberg group structure, I'll call it H. And so just to say, so if you've not seen this group structure before, if I think about R3 again as the product of R times the complex plane with coordinates T and Z, then this non-abelian multiplication that you get to do on R3 if you want. So given two points with coordinates T1, Z1, T2, and Z2, the way the non-abelian multiplication works is that T1 goes to T1 plus T2 plus the imaginary part of Z1, Z2 bar, and then Z1, Z2 go to Z1 plus Z2. This multiplication is not abelian just because I treated z1 and z2 differently here. And then the inverse in this group is just the usual additive inverse. Right, so this is so one can put four supercharges on R3 compatible with this group action, and then one can use the U1 symmetry acting on this complex plane to mix with the U1R symmetry in the n equals 2 supersymmetry algebra to do the twist. So when one does that globally, the picture one finds is the following. So in order to make this twist work globally, one has to make the following. One has to put the following data on the 3 manifold. So the first piece of data you see is that you have to have a notion of what is this complex plane at every point on the 3 manifold. And so that means, among other things, we need an oriented two-plane field on the 3 manifold, just the choice of a two-plane in every tangent fiber. So I just call that two-plane field capital H. And one way to describe this oriented two-plane field is to say that it's the kernel of a non-vanishing one-form, kappa. So kappa is just a one-form on the manifold, which is non-vanishing. And then to identify this two-plane actually with the complex plane, I need to put a complex structure. So I choose a tensor which restricts to a complex structure on every two-plane H. So J is just a complex structure on H. And so given kappa, given H, kappa, and J, I can try to, everything we're doing is in a certain sense metric. I can try to put a good metric on my 3 manifold. Analogous, for example, to this fiber metric. And the metric, and so what I can do is I can just say, I can try to say d squared of m is just two form d kappa j plus kappa tensor kappa. So rather than picking this extra closed two-form omega, which I did in that example, I don't want to have to make that choice. That actually gave me the homology. I'll try to use d kappa. And if I do that, then I find that the volume form for my manifold with the structure is just proportional to, in my notes, I had a one-half kappa d kappa, and so basically to have a good metric, I need to make sure that this three-form kappa d kappa is everywhere non-vanishing and with a suitable orientation positive on my 3 manifold. So this condition on kappa, so basically the important condition on kappa in making these choices is just that this kappa wedge d kappa is everywhere positive on my manifold. And so this is actually known as the contact condition. This condition would be exactly the same if you think about it as saying that d kappa restricted to this plane field H is everywhere positive, and so it gives me a symplectic form. And so the good thing about this setup for effectively reducing the structure group from my tangent bundle to U1 is that it always works in the sense that if you give me any compact orientable 3 manifold, I can always find a kappa and find a J such that this package goes together. And in fact, that choice is far from unique, even up to topology. There are many inequivalent structures. OK, so a final piece of this package that I need there's a vector field that corresponds to this distinguished direction R here. And so this vector field actually it's like a Euclidean time. And so it has a name. It's called the Reb vector field. Denoted by R, and this is just a vector field such that if we contract the vector field with kappa, we get 1, and if we contract the vector field with d kappa, we get 0. So this vector field is always transverse to the contact planes, and then it follows immediately that if we compute the float the lead derivative of this of the contact form kappa along this vector field just by the Cartan relation. So it's the lead derivative of the anticommutator of the contraction with the exterior derivative. These conditions say that the flow of the contact form and therefore the contact planes are invariant under this time translation. So this is just some metric package that I always have that I can use to reduce the structure group of my tangent bundle to U1 and therefore to do this kind of twisting based on this local Heisenberg model. So in fact, let me give an example basically for this Heisenberg model of R3. So for example, just in the case of R3, which actually for the example in the talk in Legendre-Knotts is the kind of the most relevant example. So the standard choice, and in fact, this is the choice that we used that was used to generate that picture at the very beginning, would just be to take kappa to be in, again, in the coordinates where this is t is a time coordinate and z is a holomorphic coordinate. Kappa is dt plus basically the angular form I over 2, z dz bar minus z bar dz. And then you can see immediately that that means that the 2 form d kappa is just the usual area form on the complex plane. And so therefore, the re field, which is the vector field whose contraction with kappa is 1 and whose contraction with this thing vanishes, is just d dt. So the time just runs vertically in this model. And then this metric, the kind of this special metric that we make from kappa in the complex structure. So if I pick, if I do everything in the most symmetric way possible, which means that I pick my complex structure to be left invariant under the action of this Lie group on itself, and that, for instance, just means that the complex structure acts in the standard way on dz and dz bar, then the metric that I find on H looks like just the usual Euclidean metric in the complex plane direction, and then plus kappa standard, tensor kappa standard. So this is dz, dz bar, and kappa are all left invariant one forms on this Heisenberg Lie group. So this is actually a left invariant metric on R3 with the Heisenberg structure. The interesting thing about this metric is just that this is not a flat metric. So it's not flat because kappa here, of course, mixes up the complex and the time directions. And since, for example, this is a non-abelian Lie group, the metric can't be flat. So this is not the usual Euclidean metric. It's some curve metric, but it has a lot of isometries. So the isometries here would just be there's an obvious isometry here by rotations in the complex plane. There's an isometry under translation. There's an isometry under translations in the time direction. And that, in fact, isometry under translations in the time direction actually fits into a general isometry by the action, the left action of R3 on itself with this non-abelian structure. So there's actually a pretty big isometry. It's not the full isometry of the usual Euclidean metric, but it's still a pretty big isometry. Okay, so right, so a really important question, actually, for what I'll be saying just in a second, is to think about what this, what the contact planes in this example actually look like geometrically. So you can't really see them in the picture that I began the talk with, but I want to draw a picture, kind of approximate picture of them. And so to get a good approximate picture, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go to the infrared. I'm just going to imagine scaling t and z homogeneously. And when I do that, if I look at the contact form whose kernel defines the planes, these two terms are inhomogeneous. This is degree 1. These terms are degree 2. So therefore, when I scale everything homogeneously, this term is irrelevant. And basically, the contact form just degenerates to something proportional to the angular form around the axis. And so what that means is that the kernel, the planes in the kernel, are just spanned by the vertical planes that extend radially outward from the axis. So the picture is just, so the picture of what these contact planes look like in this example, in the infrared, is just, I just had the t-axis here corresponding to the redirection, and then I have a bunch of planes extending radially outward vertical plane. So these are all the contact planes, H, that live in the kernel of kappa. And this is just an infrared picture. So we're not really capturing what happens near the origin. There's some twisting going on near the origin, but this is what things look like far away. Now this picture is actually very important because it actually is an example. This picture can be extended globally to give a description of what these contact planes look like on an arbitrary compact orientable three manifold. And so this is an important picture. So if I want to describe what these contact planes look like in general, the statement is the following. So I can always if you give me any compact orientable three manifold, a statement that goes back to J.W. Alexander in the 20s is that I can always present it as a kind of vibration over the circle, just like I began with a few minutes ago, provided that I remove a link. So if I have a compact orientable three manifold and I allow myself to remove an oriented link, L, this link has a name, it's always called the binding. Then this three, so if I choose this link appropriately, this three manifold will fiber in a locally trivial fashion over the circle with pages being some compact orientable surface sigma. So sigma is an oriented surface, which has a boundary. So the difference here between what we did before is that because I removed this link L from my three manifold, the surface sigma has a boundary. And the boundary will be identified with L. So if you wonder what, so sigma is called a page here. And in general, there's some monodromy. So again, there's a monodromy phi in the mapping class group of sigma. And here, because sigma has a boundary, I have to tell you something about the boundary. The condition on the boundary is just that it's the identity. It actually restricts the identity of the boundary. And so here the picture, the kind of only tricky thing about this picture is what does it mean to say that the boundary of sigma is L? And that what I'm saying here is that near the boundary of sigma, the picture is exactly this local picture here. So here, sigma would just correspond to the half planes H, and then all the half planes H, all their boundaries are identified in a circles family of half planes, just parameterized by the angle theta, and they're all identified with the vertical axis, which will be the binding L in this example. So in fact, I should say that the compact version of that example in R3, the simplest example of this kind of manifold decomposition, would just be to take, to take this picture of our Heisenberg contact structure and just add the plane at infinity to compactify to the three sphere. And then we're just saying that we can take the three sphere, if we remove an unknot from the three sphere, so L the vertical axis, we have the point of infinity just becomes the unknot. And then if we remove this unknot, we can fill the three sphere with a family of surfaces sigma. Sigma will just be the conformal compactification of the half plane, so it's just a disk. And then in this case, the monodromy in that picture is obviously trivial. Of course, the disk doesn't have any monodromy, so phi is just the identity. So that's the simple example. And then the kind of really amazing statement, in terms of this amazing statement of Alexander, was that this always works. For any compact three manifold, you can find an L such that this vibration works.
Is there any relation between the one you use to make the manifold that's circular of the sphere? Is there any relation between this L and the one you use to make the manifold that's circular of the sphere?
Yeah. Let me give you the simplest. I'll give you a slightly simpler answer, which is the simple answer is this is directly related to a Heegaard decomposition of the manifold. The Heegaard decomposition is obvious. You just take two of these surfaces sigma, which are separated by 180 degrees. They glue together to make a closed surface, And then actually the, and then if you divide the manifold by that closed surface, it's a little theorem, some elementary Morse theory, you see that's a handle body. So it's kind of Heggard decomposition where you take the Heggard surface and you cut it into two pieces. So that's the simplest relation. Yeah.
So maybe I didn't catch that. Is the topology of the leaves all the same?
The link?
The leaves. So all the sigmas.
Yes, the sigmas are all, yeah, they always have the same. Yeah. So it's exactly like, the way to think about it, it's exactly like the generalization of this picture, except that in order to get this picture to work for all three manifolds, we have to allow sigma to have a boundary. Here it doesn't have a boundary. And we have to remove the link and so that we can basically attach the, to make it compact without boundary, we have to remove the link. All right, so that's a topological statement from 1920. Let me give you a statement from 2000 about this picture, which is even more amazing. This is actually the statement. There's kind of three names attached to it. There's one statement by William Thurston Wiegand-Kimper from like the 70s, and then there's kind of another statement from Giroux in 2000, which says that this picture of the three manifold, this kind of presentation, is more or less morally in one-to-one correspondence with the topological choices of contact structures on the manifold. I say morally because one has to use some equivalence relations on these pictures. Yes?
So suppose that the manifold which has inside the link,
yes,
different from L. Do you think that there's an additional theorem that you can find now in L for which there is a foliation, where there is a patch of surface evolving around?
I would have to think a little bit. I would have to think about that. For example, the link L here has to be kind of a special link. It has to be a fibered link. So this will not work for your arbitrary. L, your question is about something different from L.
I don't think, suppose that this has some other link.
Yeah.
And I want to carve out L so that the complement of L.
Yes.
That link now is a set of points.
Yeah. Okay, and your question was?
It is possible. So if there is an extension of this theorem to three manifold with line defects.
What you just described will be, in my world, would be exactly the class of sort of transverse knots or links. So exactly the things which are transverse knots or links have that presentation. Actually, I'm talking about these Lagrangian things are kind of the opposite to those. Maybe I'll say some more things here. What I want to say was actually, I got a little bit ahead of myself there. What I want to say is what this picture, this is just a topological picture. I wanted to point out that it has a more or less direct relation to this geometric picture involving the contact plane. And the picture is that it's kind of the obvious thing. The statement is that if I give you any contact structure, this family of planes on the three manifold, then I can always deform those planes such that I can make the planes to order epsilon everywhere close to being tangent I can make the tangent to the surfaces sigma of the pages. I can make the contact planes to be order epsilon close to the pages in some open book presentation for the manifold, and the reflow for this contact structure to be tangent to the binding. So given any contact structure, I can always push it around and adapt it such that basically the contact planes look like the tangent planes to sigma, and this reflow is along the binding in an oriented fashion. Everything is oriented. Okay, so that's kind of it. So back to this kind of fantasy about this one parameter family of chiral algebras, you see, this is the kind of picture that will allow you to make sense of that on an arbitrary three manifold. Any three manifold has this kind of picture, and then the natural guess would be to look for chiral operators, which are chiral on the pages of this supporting open book for the contact structure that we use to put supersymmetry on the manifold. Just because this picture, as I say, is a natural generalization of this fiber manifold picture. Okay, so that was kind of some topological generalities. Now I actually want to try to write down my example of these supersymmetric operators in this chiral sector. So let me make one. One little remark here about the supersymmetry algebra. So for everything I'm going to be saying in the following, I need to make an assumption that's really important. And the assumption is just that the, I have this complex structure, and I need to assume that actually everything works such that the reflow preserves my complex structure. This is the same as the metric assumption that the reflow is actually an isometry for my contact metric. So this assumption, in a certain sense, is not, there are many examples where this will work. The Heisenberg metric is an example. The round metric, the standard round metric on the three sphere would give an example. And in fact, for any cipher five or three manifold, you can put this package together in such a way that the complex structure is invariant under the reflow. However, this will not work for more general three manifolds. And the situation becomes much more complicated if you do not assume that the complex structure is invariant under the reflow, effectively because the supercharged Q is time dependent in that situation. So if you're doing classical knot theory, that's not a big assumption, but for some purposes, this is a big assumption. All right, so under that assumption, then what happens is that this twisted field theory actually has two supercharges, just call them Q and Q twiddle, with a standard kind of equivariant topological algebra. Anticommutator Q Q twiddle is I times the Lie derivative in the rib direction, and then each of the Qs are nilpotent. I should say I'm assuming here that in general there could be some U1 abelian flavor symmetries that also appear in this commutator, but I'm assuming that, for example, my application to pure gauge theory, there aren't any flavor symmetries. So this is a standard equivariant algebra, and in general, both Q and Q twiddle will depend on implicitly in their definition the choice of this complex structure J. I'm not going to make that explicit. The formulas are a little bit complicated, but they both depend on J. And now there's a little simple no-go theorem that follows from this algebra. If we're interested in, for example, doing knot theory, so suppose I give you some loop operator, any supersymmetric loop operator attached to a curve C. So O of C is a loop operator for some curve C inside my three manifold M, which is half BPS. So it's annihilated by both Q and Q twiddle. Well, it immediately follows under this half BPS assumption just from the algebra that the operator is annihilated by the flow in the rev direction. And so that means that the curve C has to be in orbit of this rev flow. So this condition that the knot C is a rev orbit is actually a very restrictive topological condition. If you're interested in knots in the three sphere, the only ones which are rev orbits are torus knots. So it's another kind of point of motivation. If you want to do sort of interesting topology, meaning you don't want to make any topological restrictions on your knot, studying the half BPS sector will not get you anywhere. You have to study the quarter BPS sector, which is another motivation for considering all this quarter BPS stuff. Okay, so what I want to do in the remainder is actually to show you these chiral currents that live on the pages of the open book. Okay. So I'm going to work with the specific example of n equals 2 Yang-Mills Chern-Simon theory. So the action Yang-Mills Chern-Simons, just a kind of set of notation, looks like a Yang-Mills piece minus 1 over some coefficient 8 pi e squared integral over m trace curvature squared plus a Chern-Simons piece I k Chern-Simons interaction, where k is the level, integer in my conventions. And then there's plus dot, 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 dot. The dot, 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 dot includes the action for the real adjunct-valued scalar and this vector multiple, and then all the fermion terms. And I won't write them down because they're kind of not so useful. And in fact, when you just stare at this kind of theory with the supersymmetry, it's kind of very non-revealing just because the theory is anisotropic. And so everything, when everything's anisotropic, it kind of makes things a little bit complicated. Okay, now to find, so I want to look for supersymmetric chiral, basically chiral currents in this example. And in order to do that, as I said, the theory, if you just stare at the supersymmetry algebra and look for things annihilated by Q, it's very non-revealing. And so I'm going to make two simplifying assumptions to try to write these things down, and then we'll remove the assumptions. So the first thing I'm going to do is, because I'm looking for something which is fundamentally two-dimensional anyway, I'm just going to imagine compactifying this theory on M equals sigma times S1. So I'm just going to imagine compactifying to a surface, and then I'll look for chiral currents on the surface and then try to lift them upstairs. If I can find things downstairs, I'll try to lift them upstairs. And the other thing I'm going to do, which is maybe not so essential, but it's kind of useful for the presentation, is that I'm just going to, for the moment, assume that my gauge group G is abelian. If we can find an abelian current, then there's kind of a standard way to make it not abelian. So we might as well just make it abelian.
But is this current going to be gauge invariant? Hmm? So the current is not going to be gauge invariant?
It will not be gauge invariant. Indeed, we'll see in a second that the current is not gauge invariant. That's actually important. Yeah, I'll say more about that. It's actually necessary. The whole, we could have predicted this from the very beginning. But I'll explain this in a second. Yes, anyway, so Davide is right, exactly. We're going to find something which is not exactly gauge invariant, but that's okay. All right, so now let me just remind you. So basically we're just looking at it in equals comma 2-2 theory. If we're just working on R3 and we just do the standard thing, forget about the twisting. We're just doing basically an N equals 2 comma 2 theory. And in fact, the current is just going to live, basically. The current will just be made from the bosons. We actually won't need to use any fermions to make this current. So let me just tell you what the relevant supersymmetries are to consider in this N equals 2, 2 comma theory. So there's a two-dimensional gauge field. Delta A of Z is a twisted fermion. Lambda Z, this is a one form of type 1-0. And then delta A Z bar for my twisted Q is equal to 0. And then there's the usual complex scalar, traditionally called little sigma. Delta sigma is equal to 0. And then there's delta sigma bar is equal to some other twisted fermion alpha, which is like a scalar. And I can say because I've compactified on the circle, sigma is actually not complex valued. Sigma, in general, part of sigma comes from the holonomy of the gauge field around the circle. So sigma is actually valued in general, be valued in the complex form of the gauge group. So here, sigma for just U1, sigma is valued in the C star, and that just means concretely that sigma is periodic in the real direction. Sigma is a periodic scalar in the real direction. So that's just one important thing, actually. Okay, so these are actually, to talk about this current, these are only the supersymmetries I need to look at. And so you look at them and you say, well, we want to try to write down something which is annihilated by Q. There are obviously two things on the blackboard annihilated by Q. I can take any local operator made with a polynomial in sigma. That will be annihilated by Q. And of course, I can try to make something which is gauge invariant made from A of Z bar. That will be annihilated. Both of those things are the wrong thing to do. Local operators made from sigma, you can certainly make them supersymmetric, but actually they would actually correspond to half BPS operators in this theory. So they would be not what we're looking for. They wouldn't give you any kind of interesting chiral algebra. And the fact that A of Z bar is annihilated by the supercharge, this is really a statement that we should choose a certain gauge when we do perturbative computations. What this says is that basically we should always work at holomorphic gauge. We should, compatible with Q, if we want to fix a gauge to do some perturbative computation, we can set AZ bar is equal to 0. So this is really telling us what gauge we should pick to do computations, not how to make an operator. Okay, so otherwise you say, well, maybe we're out of luck then, because neither of the other things are annihilated. And if you didn't maybe have this picture that I had, you might have given up at that point. But you can go a little bit further and say, well, okay, nothing is obviously, anything involved from A of Z and delta sigma bar is not obviously going to be annihilated off shell by Q, but we can certainly look on shell. So on shell, we should consider relations between the fermions lambda Z and alpha that come from equations of motion. And this is a free theory, so it's very simple. So we just look at the equation of motion in this free theory. And there's basically the Dirac equation for these fermions gives it a relation involving the angles coupling 1 over e squared dz alpha is equal to, because we're at non-zero level, there's a mass term, k over 2 pi lambda z. So there's basically a massive Dirac equation since we're at non-zero level. And so if I now look at this equation, now there's an obvious combination that I can take involving az and sigma bar, which will be annihilated by the supercharged Q on shell. So I'm just going to set jz, which will be my current, as to be az plus 2 pi over e squared times k dz sigma bar. So this thing on shell, anyway, is annihilated by Q. Now, exactly as David Ace pointed out, it's not gauge invariant. So here's where the chiral anomaly comes in. So I remind you, if we're at non-zero level, what the chiral anomaly says for a chiral current is that basically there's always a dichotomy. You can either have a current which is conserved but not gauge, which is gauge invariant but not conserved, and that's usually the current you would want to work with, or you can have a current which is not gauge invariant but conserved. And so here, we actually want the current which is conserved, because conservation for a chiral current means holomorphy, we must have holomorphy. But the result of which is that it's not gauge invariant, because it has the A of Z here. In fact, the chiral anomaly says that this conserved current always will involve basically A of Z and transform like a connection. So this thing, this current is not gauge invariant, but it transforms like a connection. And so what that means is that although the current itself is gauge invariant, I can make a gauge invariant operator out of it just by making a Wilson loop with this current in the Wilson loop. So the actual gauge invariant operator, yeah, so the statement here is, let's say, so that Q of J of Z vanishes on shell, and then the actual quarter BPS Wilson loop that I can make in my two-dimensional theory is just the operator that I make by exponentiating that current around any curve C on my surface, if I do this on a surface. So I just take A plus 2 pi over E squared K times dz sigma bar. The fact that AZ bar appears in that operator doesn't make any difference because it's annihilated. Okay, so I get in this way supersymmetric Wilson loop operators in two dimensions on my surface sigma here. Okay. And they're obviously, it's not obviously, these things are obviously going to be chiral instances that I discussed. Okay, so that's actually kind of interesting already. People have not considered too much these 2-2 theories at non-zero level, but because they have these chiral currents, I think they're interesting. So let me now, what we want to do though is to take that current in two dimensions and try to lift the whole construction to three dimensions. This trick of compactification was just some kind of conceptual thing to give us some idea of what to look for. All right, so maybe in the final 5 minutes here, we'll finish up. So lift to our manifold M, some cyclic manifold with contact structure H. And so now the kind of idea is pretty clear. What we have is now we interpret this surface in three dimensions. Our topology tells us we should interpret this surface sigma as one of the pages in this open book presentation of M. So it's some surface with boundary. And we should consider curves which live, effectively plane curves which live on the surface. Because here we were working in two dimensions, we have this plane curve C there. Now, what does it mean in our three-dimensional story to have the curve C that lives on the surface sigma? Well, we remember that I said that in this relation between the contact geometry and the topology, the relation is that the contact points H, which are the kernel of the one firm kappa, are at the order epsilon the same as the tangent planes to the surface sigma in the page, away from the binding, meaning the boundary. And so what we should do is, then we want to look for are curves which have the property that, first of all, to say that we have the curve living on sigma is just to say that the tangent direction to this curve everywhere lies in the tangent plane to sigma, which is another way of saying that the tangent plane of C in the contact world everywhere lies in the contact plane H for all points on C. And this condition is the same, since H is the kernel of the one-form kappa, is saying that the contact form kappa restricted to C vanishes identically. And then this is exactly the definition that C is a Legendre map. So I told you at the very beginning that those arcs had the property that they were always tangent to planes, and that's what it means to be Legendrian. And here you see, just in certain sense, it means that the knot is a kind of plane curve. It can always be isotope to Lie as in the page of some open book presentation of the manifold. All right, and now to finish up. So now, what we do. So now we have this picture of how to think about how to translate this kind of formula for the Chiral-Wilson loop, quarter BPS-Wilson loop in two dimensions, how to think about it in three dimensions. And it's not very hard if you understand, if you play around with this contact geometry enough, and you look at this formula, it's not hard to take this formula and just translate it into a guess for what the corresponding lift upstairs in three dimensions for that operator should be. So let me just write down what that operator looks like. So the one-quarter BPS Wilson loop in three dimensions, we can just guess, should look like, so C will be a Legendre knot. Now this, we're going to write it in the full non-abelian theory. So we take, it'll be a Wilson loop operator, trace of the polynomial of around C of some quantity, which I'll call curly A, where curly A is equal to, well, we basically now we take this expression and try to lift it upstairs. So I'll say it's A minus and some pair for signs and so forth, 2 pi over E squared K, yield to R FA 1, 0 plus I partial covariant A 1, 0. Sigma, where the only thing I have to be careful about, the notation isn't great, sigma here is the real G value scalar in the usual n equals 2 multiple. So it is not the complex two-dimensional guy, it's the real G value guy. And so here you see basically the idea is that this imaginary part, the real G value scalar, basically just comes to the imaginary part of that thing sigma bar over there. The compact part of sigma bar, basically, which is the holonomy, comes from basically a piece of this curvature term here. I'd say this 1, 0 means what I'm doing is I'm taking each of these things, the contraction of the curvature with this Reeve direction, and this thing here, it's a one form, and I take the holomorphic, the piece of holomorphic anti-holomorphic type 1, 0 with respect to the contact directions. And so basically one can write this thing down, and then one just checks, so I'll just say claim, one checks directly that this thing, this Wilson loop operator on shell is annihilated by the supercharged Q on shell, precisely if the curve C is Legendre. So the business of the two-dimensional picture is just kind of a device to make a good guess. And you can just check directly now using the supersymmetry algebra that actually is annihilated on shell. You have to use the fact that at a certain point when you vary this Wilson loop operator, you'll find some terms involving fermions that involve the contact form kappa. So here the Legendre condition kills those terms, and the other terms vanish by fermion equation of motion. This is an on shell operator. Okay, and again, this operator is chiral, since I discussed before. Okay, I should say it differently. So the interesting thing about this is just that these operators, Legendre knots, I should have said, are very flexible knots. Any topological knot can be moved into a Legendrian form. So basically, you have now all of knot theory. We're just doing the usual pure integral to gauge theory, but you have all of knot theory at your disposal now with these supersymmetric operators. They have an interesting property also, too, that the usual kind of, for the happy BS operators, you can study, of course, you can both study these operators at weak, of course, you have the Yang-Mills term, so you can study these at weak Yang-Mills coupling, do some localization. For the usual happy BS operators, they can be treated perturbatively because they don't involve the Yang-Mills coupling. These operators, though, you see, of course, because they're on shell, they do involve the Yang-Mills coupling. So basically, this Wilson loop operator, we're going to have to do something a little bit more complicated. It acts as a source for the fields when you study that thing at weak coupling. Of course, these things in the infrared, the angles that coupling the term involving E squared goes away, and these are just the usual bosonic Wilson loops in Chern-Simons theory, which produce all of the standard Jones polynomial, not invariants, and so forth. Okay, so I think I'll end there.
If you try to like kind of cut this manifold and find a boundary condition so that the boundary theory, like with boundary theory giving this chiral theory that you want, you would not expect that to have Virasoro currents?
I really don't think it's like natural to cut this manifold. The theory only preserves one supercharge. I don't think it's natural when you only have one supercharge, or at least you're studying this. The theory, if we do it in this special case, has two supercharges, so maybe in that case it's natural. But in the case where you have one supercharge, I don't think it's very natural to cut the manifold. Or when you're studying this sort of quarter BPS sector, I don't think it's natural to cut the manifold.
I'm trying to understand the analogy with, you know, the usual story about Chern-Simons and WCW.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is a different version of that. I mean, the one thing I would say is that...
I think that what I'm saying is maybe correct, that the chiral theory you don't want it to have Virasoro currents. Like there's not a.
That's right.
You don't expect there to be some kind of braiding of local operators in the chiral theory, which is computing the corresponding kind of braiding of these Legendre.
Right. Yeah. This is not even awesome. It's not even clear that these things can be braided. The Legendre knots. The topologists. I don't know any theorem in the topology. And they prove things like this, but I don't know any theorem, and it's not clear to me how these things, even topologically, can be braided. So the usual kind of picture involving the Virasoro braid and so on and so forth, I'm not giving you that from this picture at all.
Next, I just want to point out WCW, that is more like a topological domain world
than the WCW. That's right, yeah.
But in the 3D picture, it may be useful. These circles on the surface are lifting to operators, which are not just on one of the surfaces, but they're passing through.
Like
what you asked earlier.
Yeah, those are different. Yeah, I mean, those are different knots. I mean, these are the ones that live on the surfaces. They're not the ones that go, of course, transverse.
No, that's right.
Those are different things. I don't know that those things can make. I don't know whether or not the ones you want can be made supersymmetric. That's a question. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
When you said this thing though about how
for that matter.
Yeah, I don't know whether or not this construction can. It's very delicate because this is totally on shell. You asked before, and I spent a little bit more time thinking about that. It's still not clear that this. I mean, it'd be great. I'd really love to add matter to this to sort of look for a kind of TQFT which is actually sensitive to this contact structure or foliation and kind of. Basically, if you can make anything that doesn't flow to the bosonic Chern-Simons theory, which sort of you would expect it to depend on this contact topology.
Yes.
But I don't, it's very delicate. With a little bit more effort, it's not the main focus of my efforts now, but with a little bit more effort, I did not, still have not seen that this thing could be made super
smooth. I wouldn't be surprised that if you could get maybe super coaching signals using that.
Oh, that's an idea.
These Legendre knots, if you intersect them with one of these surfaces, they intersect at a point or along the line?
You should think about, they live on the surface. The picture
you have this order epsilon thing here, right? So they're really, they're It's just that they evolve in a very specified way.
The thing is that the service amount doesn't exist. That's why there's an order epsilon. The contact planes are everywhere non-integral, so they're never tangent to anything. It's just that non-integrality condition is open condition. So I can make them to draw a picture as close as I want. But they are always in the they're always tangent to the contact plane. So in that sense, they're always in the contact plane. If you make the knot just a little bit transverse to the contact plane, then you have what Davide was asking about. You have a transverse, what they call a transverse knot. A transverse knot is just a knot which is everywhere transverse to the contact plane. Those things can be braided, but I don't know whether they can be made supersymmetric. The ones which I know can be made supersymmetric are the ones which are at Reeve orbits. Those are always transverse, but those are what have BPS kind of an
option. I'm really ready to bet somehow you can make this work for very special matter only.
Yeah.
And it will give you essentially super hope.
I see. That should definitely be thought more about for sure. Yeah. I'd say there are a lot of.
Then you could define a logical theory for a supergroup, and then you could try to walk backwards.
Right.
That's
a
logical
theory. Yeah. Good idea.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.